Be part of it.
BBC Radio Leicester.
Good morning. Now, this week we've been looking at the effect of an in or out result on the European referendum and the impact of either outcome on our lives in Leicestershire and Rutland. Now, much of the talk nationally about this campaigning has been about the powers that Brussels has on our lives, with things like European law, with things like immigration, with things like how we pay so much money to be in Europe each year. But being part of Europe goes much deeper than that, and it affects every single one of us. Today we're looking at the impact the EU has on our public sector. So how does what goes on over there affect what happens over here? What role does it play in things like our NHS, our police force, our universities, etc.? And how might that change following the outcome of the referendum within the next 2 years? Well, joining me to discuss this in more detail is Dr. Steve Pearce. Steve's a professor of EU law at the University of Essex. Philip Blond is director of the think tank Respublica. Dr. Mike Goldsworthy is programme director at Scientists for EU. But before we hear from them, let's take a moment to listen to 21-year-old student at De Montfort University who moved here from Lithuania 2 years ago. She's been describing some of the opportunities that Britain, being in the EU, has brought her, but also the challenges that she's faced.
My name is Camilla Poloskita. I am studying mathematics at De Montfort University. I chose UK just because I knew if I wanted to graduate in my country, I wouldn't have the prospects to go and work abroad. Mm-hmm. If I came to UK, I would have more prospects to study anywhere in the world, because obviously the universities in UK are more well known. And I chose Leicester just because I have family here, and it's I already had people who I know here, and of course I've been working a lot. And I've been working with British citizens, and one of them actually said to me, oh, why did you come here? Like, to my face, why did you come here? You should all leave, blah, 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 blah. And it was just like, I felt really insulted, like, because I came here to study, because my future goal is to become a teacher and actually educate other people, not just, oh, I want to work here and just, like, live on benefits or anything else. And it's just like, it's really, really uncomfortable to hear these words. I don't think I've done anything wrong to the country yet, because I also pay the taxes and everything else. When she told me that, I didn't really know how to react. I just walked away, because I didn't feel that I did something really that wrong, that she actually said to me, why did you come here, saying you, as in for all the immigrants. Because the only reason why people come to UK are to earn a bit more, probably send the money to their back to their families and everything else. I don't think that other people are looking at it that way.
Well, there you go. One of the students, 21-year-old at De Montfort University, who moved here from Lithuania 2 years ago. And, of course, the impact of that yes-no vote will be felt, indeed, on our universities here in the UK. Dr. Steve Pearce, as I said, is Professor for EU Law, University of Essex. Welcome to the programme. Good to talk to you this morning.
Good morning.
I mean, as things are, what do we get from the EU when it comes to our universities and indeed, British students as well?
Well, there's a lot of research money, which I think Mike Goldsworthy can probably talk about in more detail. But from the point of view of the day-to-day of the students, there's a significant number of students who come to British universities, around 125,000, I think we've estimated. And the estimate's about £2 billion income for the economy, 19,000 jobs created as a result of that. And then a lot of our academic staff come from the EU as well. But then, of course, it works the other way around, because EU British students can go to other EU universities. Many do on an Erasmus program for a year or for a whole degree, and they have to be treated equally with other students there. So, you know, Germany charges no tuition. British students can go there for that lower tuition. They can go for the lower tuition in Ireland or Dutch system and so on. And, of course, British staff who work in universities as professors or lecturers, secretaries, and so on, they can all apply for jobs in other EU countries. And so that would be jeopardised if we left.
So it's that movement, that ability to travel, that's a big part, and also, as you say, research money as well, which is a big part of university income, as we know, because they're always looking to bring in students from abroad and also to seek extra funding for development, really. Philip Blond, director of the think tank Respublica, your thoughts on this morning. I mean, from the point of view of the sort of the public sector and the broader public sector, does leaving the EU potentially harm what our public sector workers are dealing with at the moment?
It's a difficult question because there's, you know, pluses and minuses on the balance sheet. I think what's very clear is that the public, because of the free movement of people, essentially, because Britain's one of the few growth spots in the world, Britain itself is over, you know, huge numbers of people come here to find work, they build families here, and the public sector can find itself quite overwhelmed in terms of schooling and in certain areas, doctors and so on. But if you do the macro calculations, you know, net benefits, it's very clear that migrants bring enormous economic gains. I mean, if you want to be really hard-faced about it, we essentially import very economically active people who don't claim benefits and who work and produce a large number of benefits, including taxes for the public sector. And we export retired people. We export retired people to Spain, to Portugal, and they're the ones who cost money. So if you're actually doing a big macro analysis, there's the economic gains to Britain in terms of importing young, often highly educated, active people is clear. It's true that those economic gains don't actually find their way down often to the public sector. But you might make the argument, for instance, that the recent $8 billion won by Jeremy Hunt for the NHS could indeed be the surplus from those workers. So really, if you really want to do an account of, you know, the costs and the benefits, I think on a macro level, it's very clear migration's an economic benefit. But I think there is an issue with indigenous, often working class people find it very difficult now to move into jobs because those jobs are often taken by highly educated Europeans who have a work culture and also are interested in kind of the lower level jobs. And employers, when faced with often British people who are very low skilled and require a lot of training, and European workers who are often highly skilled and don't need so much training, they opt for the latter. And I think there is a way in which the pathways for working class people have essentially been disrupted. I'm in London now. London has a large number of people, you know, remaining not in education or training, but I'm nowhere served by anyone who's from these islands. And so I think that is an issue. But if you actually look at the outside of that micro picture, the macro, it's a clear win. And I think I would argue that actually that it's even a win for the public sector because the gains to the economy are in the end used to support the public sector.
It's interesting you say that, because, I mean, you know, here in Leicester, and I don't expect you to know all about this, of course, which is why I explain it, but here in Leicestershire we've got our fire men and women who are at the moment worried about their jobs. There's going to be cuts to the fire service. We've got a police force that's budget is incredibly stretched, and they're having to make real hard, tough choices in how the future of policing across Leicestershire and Rutland runs. Both our local authorities, Leicestershire County Council, says there's no money in the pot, and the County Council says, you know, we're not getting enough money out of government, we're not getting a fair deal, so we've had to make cuts too. And yet we seem to have more and more people that are in the country, and some would argue, well, actually, do you know what? They haven't brought any extra wealth with them because we're still seeing all these cuts and all these savings that have to be made. And actually, the reason why our NHS is overstretched, the reason why there are far too many cars on the roads, the reason why there aren't enough houses out there is because we've allowed too many people through our doors.
Well, that's demonstrable nonsense. Let me give you some figures. If you want to look at our NHS, the overwhelming source of the crisis in the NHS are people with chronic long-term conditions like dementia, obesity, diabetes, and they're often old people. These are from a cohort before migration.
Right.
And they are, if you go to any British hospital in these islands today, and you analyse each hospital. In each hospital, there'll be 30 to 40% of people in that hospital who shouldn't be in hospital. But the reason they've ended up in hospital is they come from a social care sector that can't care for them, and they've got nowhere else to go back to because we've destroyed family structures in this country. And that they also, we don't have sufficient community care to keep people out of hospital. So if we really want to stop the cuts, actually much of our local state is woefully inefficient and woefully ineffective. We need to redesign the state. And for instance, it was my idea to devolve health to Manchester. I wrote the original report for devolution. And what we have to do is recognize our state is incredibly badly structured, incredibly expensive. Just a couple of details. We've got enormous amounts of money coming to places like Leicester, but it comes through different ring fencing, it comes from different funding lines. McKinsey have shown that each level of management, each funding goes through, loses 30% of the budget on the front line. And in every area, you've got hundreds of layers of management and hundreds of difference of funding line with lots of different performance indicators, and the state fights with itself at enormous cost. And what I think we need to do in terms of our public sector is we need to redesign our public sector from the bottom up. We need to create whole person, holistic care for people. And that, I think, will result in a far more efficient state. Even if we didn't have migrants coming in, what we would actually have is a system that's still in crisis, and we'd have less money to deal with it. The economic case for migrants is very clear. What isn't clear is we don't have a good social case. We're not very good at integrating. Mm. The project of multiculturalism has too often resulted in separate development, communities living apart, people being suspicious of one another. Mm. What we need to do is actually welcome these people, but have a strong sense of British values and inculcate those values into them, so they become the new Britons, which of course is what they are.
All right. I'll come back to you in a moment, Philip, because listening patiently on the line is Mike Galsworthy, Dr. Mike Galsworthy, Programme Director at Scientists for EU. And Mike, I guess you straddle both the opinions of Steve and also of Philip, because you say that the EU allows for greater science projects which can benefit Europe through health, the economy and also the environment as well.
Both Steve and Philip are absolutely right. They're bang on. The immigrants that we have come in are a very clear benefit to our economy. So they pay their way and more. And we see that also within research and innovation. I mean, at the moment, British research and innovation is world leading in terms of productivity, in terms of what we put out for the money we get in. We are top in the world. And that's not just British scientists, that's scientists in Britain. And we've got a lot of talent that we attract here. Now, one of the reasons, according to the government's own report, why the UK does so well, is that we're more international now. So more than 50% of our output, our papers, are actually international, and they're shown to have greater impact than domestic-only papers. America is still stuck on 33% international. Now, a lot of that internationality obviously comes down to our relationship with the EU, because our budget, our EU budget, into which the UK is a contributor, allows us to do those complex, bespoke, multinational projects that benefit all of us. And as Philip was saying, with our NHS, for example, clearly what our NHS needs at the moment is a ton of research around all the efficiencies and how it operates. Now, from the basic science in terms of finding cures for cancer, right through to how we handle our systems, including the data, we need to be having more research around that, because it's a very complex system. And our own government doesn't seem to be getting this, because our fund into research and innovation has been stagnant and slipping, and now we're maybe facing further cuts. Look over to what the EU are doing. With a shrinking budget, they have been ramping up the funds, and they are tending to put a lot more at the applied end, a lot which links universities with businesses large and small, and a lot which tackles those common challenges that we face, whether it be around health, on, you know, on systems, on deep level research, on rare diseases, on cancer screening. There are fantastic projects going on in those at the moment that benefit us all. But then also, of course, in sustainability, around the common environment that we share, or energy transition needs, which also need us to cooperate cross borders. So there's a lot of people talking about how we're net contributors, so we're putting money in and it's just going to the other countries. I mean, if that were the case, that it was just about moving money around, there'd be no point in it all. Mm. But proper economic analysis shows, as the formal in campaign that have just launched said, that for every 340 quid put in, the economic benefits back are 3,000. So that's on a per family per annum basis. And that's what the EU is all about, and this is very demonstrable within the area of research and innovation. There have been some people who said that scientists are only arguing for the EU because we get grants from the EU and we care about money, money, money. Well, if it was money that we cared about, we would say, we're a net contributor, don't put money through the middleman, give it to us directly. But we don't... But that's not the main concern.
Not how it
works. The
main
concern is how we deliver benefit for the public. Where do we get maximum value for the UK taxpayer money in order to do all the things that we need to do, A, that stimulates the economy and innovation, and B, that tackles all those social needs, like health of an ageing population, like energy, and like environment. And this extra layer that we get through putting some of our funds through the EU pays us dividends. Imagine if I had a lab in the UK and I wanted to work with, you know, a German company and a lab in Spain and another lab in Holland, and we didn't have this common pot of funds that we could just go and apply to straight away like we do now.
We'd get left out.
Exactly, it's a massive bureaucracy saving that we have at the moment.
All right. Steve, I mean, as Professor of EU Law, whenever EU law is presented in the media in the UK, it's often with the red tops or sometimes the Daily Mail, of course, or quite often the Daily Mail, about some of the bonkers laws that have come over here from Brussels that we must abide by. But there are obviously a lot of EU laws that help us, that we rely on, that perhaps, you know, even though we might put trust in our own politicians, I don't know if that's the right phrase, but although we might trust them when we vote for them, there are still things that the EU can offer us, aren't there?
Yes, there's a lot of things like consumer laws and environmental laws, for instance, which are perhaps stronger than laws that we'd pass left to ourselves, or they're more enforceable maybe than laws we'd have for ourselves. I mean, there was a case that went up to the Supreme Court last year about clean air in London, just trying to make enforceable the rules on the air that Londoners breathe. Of course, there's a problem in many other cities too, that you could bring cases to try and enforce it. There's rules on women's equality, for instance, that are a key part of what the EU's been doing for years. And then, of course, there's the obvious trade issue. The number of people whose jobs in manufacturing or services are linked to trade with the EU is substantial. It's about half of our exports. So those are all key advantages, and then, of course, consumers have advantages in the wider variety of wine and many other products they can buy that come from the European Union that we might not have access to at such the same low prices if we left.
Can I just ask each of you as well, to sort of as we conclude this, can I just ask each of you as well, is there room for negotiation? Because a lot of people, when we've been having this debate throughout the week about various areas that Europe applies to our lives and various, you know, it's not quite as simple as yes, we should be in it, yes, we should be out of it. There's this area of negotiation, this middle ground. Are there still, if I go around each of you, Steve, still areas for wiggle room, still areas that could be negotiated for a better outcome for the UK?
Yes, it's a bit hard to know exactly where the negotiations are going, but I think the Prime Minister was talking about restricting access to benefits. That might be something that could be agreed a little bit, and some points about focusing more on competitiveness and perhaps getting the UK exempt from some laws that might cause a cost for hospitals, for instance. That kind of thing could still possibly be negotiated.
Philip, where is the room for negotiation? It's interesting benefits was mentioned there. I mean, you could end up perhaps forecasting that we have European benefits if we're all of the same. So there doesn't seem to be a soft, tough country. If we've all got the same kind of benefits, that could work, couldn't it, or not?
Well, I don't believe in something for nothing. I don't think that works. I tend to think that benefits should be contributory, and what you pay in, you get out. And
what if you arrive with nothing, though?
Well, if you arrive with nothing, unless you're an asylum seeker, then I think asylum, you should be, you know, you're entitled, and we should fulfill our traditions. But I think very few people arrive with nothing. And actually, if you look at the data, the people who are people smuggled are often the upper middle class and the educated. The point I make about benefits is that I think the Prime Minister is right. I think it's perfectly defensible and right to say that you can't have British benefits until you've paid in to British benefits. And I think that would attain widespread popular support. I think the point on things like EU law is things that what people object to is the seeming protection of terrorists when actually the British state finds it very, very hard to control people who do need controlling. And I think the scope to reduce the powers of the European Court, that Germany has a constitutional veto. I think it's right and proper for individual states to protect, to have subsidiarity, if I can coin an awful term, to protect what's most important for them. What I fear about the EU is it's becoming an EU that says everything has to be the same. And I don't think any union works where you have to give up your specific differences.
We can work much closer by being very different in a way.
And that's the type of society where you can live at peace with one another.
All right. And
I think that's the type of society we should pursue.
Okay. Mike, a final word to you, really, on this idea of sort of renegotiation of our role within Europe. You talked about lots of things that are positive for Britain, positive for people here in Leicestershire and Rutland.
Yeah.
But is there more we can get at? I mean, there must be some room for negotiation still on this.
Oh, absolutely. And I would agree with what a lot of Steve was saying about sort of loosening up the relationship a bit. I think a lot of people are, and probably rightly, afraid of the ever closer union and everything being more homogenized and restricted. And I think it's important that Cameron does come back with something so that people see that the EU is responsive. I mean, certainly from the scientist front, we know that the EU is very responsive to what we say to them, you know, and what our community communicates to them in terms of the change we want. They're very responsive. They're probably more than our own government. But I think the British public need to see that. But more importantly, there are very, very good things about the EU, and there are things where there are problems. And of course you're going to have that in, you know, a collection of 28 countries. But the question is, do we want to leave to jettison all the bad things, then try and scramble back some of the good things, or do we want to stay in and collaboratively work out the bad things? And I'm very strongly for the latter.
Good to speak to you all. Thank you very much indeed for your time, Dr. Mike Galsworthy, Philip Blond, and Dr. Steve Pearce. Thank you very much. And as always, you can have your thoughts on the comments from our guests this morning. You can text me on 81333. Start your text message with the word Leicester. You can also phone in as well. 81333 is our text number. Start your message with the word Leicester. The phone-in number is 0116-251-1049. And, of course, you can find me on Twitter, at JLambon. Leave me your thoughts there. Right, 10:34.
BBC Radio Leicester.